here's something that caught my attention earlier this year. A Sentinel event alert from the Joint Commission that read in part, current trends and evidence suggest that maternal mortality rates may be increasing in the U.S. That's a quote. The alert then goes on to explain that deaths of moms giving birth, while still rare and while possibly explained in part by better reporting, still comes in at 13.3 deaths of mothers for every 100,000 live births. This year is the year that Healthy People 2010, a government initiative, was hoping to report no more than 3.3 deaths per 100,000 live births. Some of what's coming into view may be underlying risks associated with obesity and diabetes and high blood pressure, but it's a complex picture, which is why I have assembled some real frontline experts today to help us see where the problems are and where and how care is improving and how you can get engaged. I'm Madge Kaplan. I'm the host and producer of WIHI. That's a free online audio discussion from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. I'm also IHI's Director of Communications, and that's how I often keep track of what's going on with IHI's own work on safer perinatal and maternal care in the U.S. and globally. And I'm going to get right to my introductions, and I want to remind everyone these are just very brief descriptions of all these talented people, so I invite you to check out their fuller bios posted on our website. Joining by phone is Maureen Corey. She's Executive Director of Childbirth Connection, which at its core promotes evidence-based maternity care and improvement. Welcome, Maureen.
Thank you, Madge.
Glad to have you with us. Also on the phone is Rima Jolive, who works alongside Maureen as Associate Director of Programs at Childbirth Connection. Among other things, Rima is a certified nurse midwife, so she brings that perspective to bear on her work, too. Welcome, Rima.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. How did I do with your last name? Jolive?
Perfect.
Oh, good. Okay. Dr. Peter Taruni has dialed in and logged on from Vermont. Peter is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Vermont College of Medicine. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon, everyone.
All right. And Peter is also IHI faculty, and he works alongside Sue Gullo, who's here with me in the studio. Sue Gullo is a managing director at IHI, and she's knee-deep guiding an active community on frontline providers seeking to improve perinatal care. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you, Madge. Thanks, everyone.
All right. So a couple notes as we get started. There is tremendous material that I was introduced to getting ready for this program. Some of you may be well aware of a lot of it. A couple of things we noted on our webpage for you when we were asking people to enroll in the program, a substantial report on evidence-based maternity care and a compilation of some facts and figures. These items have now been combined into a wonderful resource document that's posted to IHI.org by tomorrow. It goes along with an archived audio of today's program. So I just want to mention that to you so you don't despair, and as you hear names of things being referenced and links and that kind of thing, just know that we're capturing all of it and it will go into the resource document. All right, so here we go. Maureen Corey, I'm going to start with you. On January 28th of this year, your organization issued a press release and it had this headline on it: Landmark reports for revamping U.S. maternity care system point to rapid gains in quality and value that are within reach. And as I read that, I had to read it again. I thought that's a wallop of a headline. We have here a situation that says gains are in reach, but we've got to revamp the whole thing. And I didn't know whether to be relieved or overwhelmed. So I thought no one better to explain exactly how we sort of make sense of all of that than you, Maureen. Welcome. And tell us what Childbirth Connection is up to right now.
Sure, Madge. Well, thank you all for joining us today. It's a pleasure to be with you. Let me start by telling you a bit about Childbirth Connection to put things in context before I speak about the headlines that Madge just alluded to. The Maternity Center Association was established back in 1918 in New York City, and we've worked for 92 years on behalf of women, newborns, and families to improve the quality of maternity care. And we have a wonderful, rich history of helping to establish and spread basic elements of the maternity care system, everything from prenatal care to maternity care nursing in the early 20th century, to nurse midwifery education, to childbirth and parenting education, and also to care in freestanding birth centers. But really, since the year 2000, we've focused our work on fostering evidence-based maternity care and quality improvement, mostly through policy and health systems change. And as we all know, it's been about 9 years since the publication of the Institute of Medicine's Crossing the Quality Chasm report, and the United States as a whole has taken big leaps forward in understanding and addressing broad deficits in the healthcare quality of our health systems. However, at Childbirth Connection, we felt that until recently, most quality improvement efforts have largely bypassed a major segment of the healthcare system, which is the maternity care delivered to women, newborns, and families who experience over 4.3 million births annually. And we know from our 2008 Milbank Memorial Fund report, the title is Evidence-Based Maternity Care, What It Is and What It Can Achieve, that routine maternity care is not consistent with lessons from the best available research and is often procedure intensive and costly. And we do also know that we have a wealth of high-quality evidence available and experiences from high-performing segments of the maternity care system that we know work to improve maternity care quality. But yet we found that these resources were not impacting most women and newborns. So to the headline that you mentioned before, Matt, we really felt that rapid gains in the quality, value, and cost of maternity care are well within reach. So we launched our Transforming Maternity Care project about 3 years ago.
All right. Okay. Well, we're going to learn more about that. And I really thank you, Maureen. And I'm going to invite people, of course, to also think of questions that the, and things they want to understand more about the work. But let's keep going. Rima, let me turn to you. You put together this interesting facts and figures document that I think packs a pretty powerful punch in terms of who and what's affected in lives and health issues and dollars related to maternity care. You want to paint that picture for us?
Sure. Yes, and just to let you know, as Jesse said, this is going to be included in your resources as of tomorrow. And I know we all believe that maternity care is very important, but I think even those of us who are slugging away every day at it sometimes don't realize what a sleeper it is in terms of the major impact and the major proportion of the health sector that it represents. As Maureen mentioned, there are 4.3 million births a year. That was in 2007, the largest number ever registered. But care for childbearing women and newborns is by far the most common reason for hospitalization. In fact, of all those discharged from U.S. hospitals in 2007, 25% were childbearing women and newborns. And 6 of the 10 most common hospital procedures are maternity-related. Cesarean section is number 3. And that may not be so surprising when we realize that it's the most common hospital operating room procedure in the country. And for the 11th consecutive year, we've hit an all-time record high cesarean rate at 31.8%. It's sort of interesting to note that that as Maureen was discussing how there's large variation in the practice that we see and doesn't necessarily reflect reliably best evidence, that cesarean rates vary by payer. So they're highest in the private insurance market, and uninsured women have an 8% rate difference. They have an 8% rate difference in the rate of cesarean. So in private markets, it's 33.7%, whereas for uninsured women, it's 25.4%. We've also seen VBAC rates declining 73% since 1997, so that they were 35.3% in 97, and in 2006 they were down to 9.7%.
Rima, so I know there's a very informed group, I'm sure, on today, but maybe just remind people what you mean by VBAC.
Oh, vaginal birth after cesarean.
Thanks.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. No problem. I just wanted to make sure people were following along. Go ahead.
So when you see that, then we look at population-based indicators, commonly reported maternal outcomes, maternity care outcomes, and we see they're all going in the wrong direction. So preterm birth has been rising for 2 decades, low birth weight has been steadily rising for 25 years, maternal mortality, as you alluded to in your opening, is going up instead of down. And I think the biggest wallop sometimes that a lot of people don't realize when we're talking about the strides that we could make and the impact in value, cost, and quality that that improvements in maternity care could make is that the combined charges just for the facility-based portion of maternity care for mothers and newborn infants was $86 billion in 2006. 42% of that, of those childbirth-related hospital stays in the country are billed to Medicaid. So you can see that there are really, there's a lot at stake.
Okay. I think that really illustrates quite a bit, and it sort of points to a lot of points of intervention and leverage also. Sue and I were just talking before we got started about the new health care reform legislation and sort of thinking about all the opportunities and things that are also going to be kind of writ large as we move forward. So thanks, Rima. I'm going to turn now to Sue Gullo, who's here with me in the studio, and I hope Sue won't mind my teasing her. I've often heard her muttering under her breath almost, misuse, underuse, overuse, misuse, underuse, overuse. And I know that that's a phrase that's sometimes used to describe really an overall agenda for improving health care. But Sue is talking about something very, very particular, I think, related to the work in perinatal and maternal health. So, Sue, I hope you don't mind if I provoke you that way.
Thanks, Madge. I would say probably 10 years ago, these terms were not familiar to me, but we certainly in the 90s began to frame things differently when we saw the initial shift begin to be focused on a more interventive delivery system here in the U.S. in hospital-based care. And again, I know many of the callers on our line today are hospital-based, and so my comments will be framed to that, but there are certainly other models of safety delivery practices that occur out of the hospital. But focusing on that, because that is also the area that my expertise is in, is with looking at misuse, underuse, and overuse, and it actually has become a mantra in our perinatal community work that Dr. Chiruni and I are involved in, is looking at the system as it currently stands and opportunities to look at that system. As we say here at IHI, the system is perfectly designed to get the results it achieves, and so we have a very intervention-based system where we've moved to a 9-to-5 obstetrics pattern where many of the deliveries occur Monday through Friday. There are plenty of statistics to support this. And so when we look at birth and how it should be normal, we have lots of opportunities to begin to frame that misuse, overuse, and underuse. So there, and specifically when we look at overuse, some of our results in the perinatal community are looking at the increase in admissions to an elevated level of care for the newborn. So over the past year, in fact, we've had hospitals that have seen a reduction in hundreds of transfers to NICU when they have implemented reliable care and have decreased the interventions that are done, such as elective deliveries prior to 39 weeks. So again, looking at that framework, it should sort of get everyone's hair on the back of their neck up, but they then should take it as an opportunity to say, what does that mean, and what does it mean at my local level?
Okay. Maybe just a quick follow-up before I turn to Peter, Sue, you referred to reductions in elective delivery. What other kinds of things would you say are kind of turning point interventions that you think can begin to change the picture?
Well, oftentimes people don't, we get into these patterns where we do what we have become accustomed to doing, and it's that opportunity to stand out and look at things differently. So looking at, we have increased interventions because we set the pathway for increased interventions. We have patients, once they appear in the hospital, we begin to do interventions because they're there, versus looking and as childbirth education has gone down and patients have become more, mothers have become less interested in being more up to date on what they should do to position themselves as their key informant to their care, and more dependent on hospitals and epidurals, we've seen results with keeping those patients home so that they're empowered to take care of the early part of labor, so then they don't have interventions forced upon them in the hospital. But our work is on, once in the hospital, what do we need to do based on evidence to reliably keep mom and baby safe?
Okay, thank you very much, Sue Gullo. Again, this is WIHI. Guy, and I'm Madge Kaplan, and Maureen Corey and Rima Jolivet are also on the phone, as is Dr. Peter Cheruny, who I want to turn to next. So, Peter, I'm wondering if you think future OBGYNs are ready for this portfolio of work and this mindset. Is that what they think they're getting into by choosing this area of medicine? And what about OBGYNs practicing now?
Well, just to take a step back, we have generally chosen medical science to help drive our improvement in medical care over really a century. So we've seen maternal mortality drop 90% in the last 50 to 60 years. So we've seen dramatic improvements on the big issues. So there wasn't a lot of emphasis on some of the refineries in the options. And now we're really looking at how do we take advantage if we're going to go to and remain in a hospital-based system. How do we take advantage of a hospital-based system without, as Sue suggested, feeling we have to push toward intervention that may not be necessary except for the patients there. And in that setting, we are seeing the research both in the quality areas and the questions involving the refinement of it, questions around the things that are being done, around epidural use, around forceps, vacuum use. We've seen continual drops for that, but on the other hand, we've seen an increase in cesarean delivery, as was noted, and as we're generally seeing, not a consistent use of the indications, if you will, around the cesarean section. And the questions have been asked on a national level, where the involvement is from the provider standpoint, maternal request cesarean section, is that an appropriate way that obstetrics should be moving? And the fallout regarding VBAC, vaginal birth after cesareans, over the last 10 years, and revisiting that issue quite recently at the national level to say, where should we be with each of these issues so that we are developing the science around the improvement, issues themselves.
Okay.
And most importantly, applying what we know now. How do we make sure it gets appropriately applied?
So, Peter, I'm good. Thank you. I'm going to also ask you maybe just you're so nicely soft-spoken in the midst of all of us here. Our booming voices. So don't be shy about speaking up a little bit louder. I wanted maybe just a quick follow-up for you. So maybe to get back to that original question, which is, do you feel as though that the OBGYNs are sort of looking for new kinds of options and a new way to approach their whole engagement and interaction with pregnant moms? Is that too big and broad a subject? Hello, Peter, did we lose you?
Is that back to me?
Yes, that is. So sorry. I thought I stumped the stars here.
Well, I certainly can speak for what we've seen nationally through IHI and the Perinatal Project as well as locally. We're human. Even as medical providers, we're going to adapt to patterns that also complement other areas of our lives, like our personal lives. And we do create... and I'd go as far as say sometimes fabricate support in our own minds and in others that this is a reasonable way of practice. And what we're bringing to the table, I think, through IHI is a reminder of the data that does or doesn't support certain means of practice, and that we need to be accountable for that type of practice. Locally, I think we clearly have seen that response in many hospitals within the IHI system. We've also seen that response. The big framework nationally probably has the most discussion right now is around the elective deliveries prior to 39 weeks and the March of Dimes focus on the late preterm delivery. The bulk of the increase in preterm delivery that you heard about earlier is in that late preterm population, and elective deliveries around that issue has clearly contributed to that. Okay. So we now are in a position where we can look at those fairly small but real differences in those outcomes and put some focus on that, because that's where a lot of the gain in outcome can come from.
Okay.
So I think the providers, as well as our upcoming residents who are looking at OBGYN, they get that. They understand that we're refining quality at our practice level to a point where perhaps we didn't have the information to do that previously.
Okay, that's very helpful. All right, thanks. All right, Jesse, I want you to cue that slide about the blueprint for action, steps towards a high-quality, high-value maternity care system. So this is just a flavor of some stuff drawn from quite a substantial body of material. I'm going to turn to Maureen and Rima now and ask them to kind of give us some sort of a high-level view of these recommendations, and really I'll leave it to the two of you. Rima, you want to start first about sort of the vision and the blueprint, and then we'll talk a little bit more about some of these particular recommendations.
Sure. Yeah, so Maureen alluded to the Milbank report that sort of launched the idea for this Transforming Maternity Care project. And it really laid out in a clear overview the patterns of overuse and underuse and misuse of practices in typical maternity care, and that got us to thinking that really if there is such a wealth of knowledge and it's not being reliably applied in practice, which I think is very much in keeping with what the IHI community focuses on, is reliability and fidelity to best practices and evidence, then why is that? And so this project focused on looking at the systemic and structural factors of the system that may be acting as challenges and barriers to reliable application of evidence in practice. And so it started out with a vision paper, which was a multi-stakeholder development, and that vision sort of put forward values and principles organized around the IOM framework of six aims and then elaborating to the distinctive features of maternity care and said, okay, here are the values and principles we think should undergird the maternity continuum. And then here are goals for care at each stage of care. And then here are the attributes of a system, health organizations, and a macro environment that would best support that. And out of that, we gave that vision, along with a Milbank report, to five stakeholder work groups. You can see, I see it's up on the screen.
Aren't we good?
Perfect, exactly. So that we could bring in the perspectives of all these actors who contribute so significantly to the system and yet often don't get a chance to talk to each other and don't get a chance to think about what are the problems and how can we get towards solutions. So those five stakeholder work groups developed sector-specific reports saying from our community standpoint, this is what we could pony up to move towards the vision. And I mention that because it's a very interesting set of resources, and each of those reports, which give that specific perspective from each of those stakeholder sectors, are also available on the website. But then those five reports were synthesized into a comprehensive roadmap, the Blueprint for Action, which really sets out to answer the question, who needs to do what, to, with, and for whom in the next 5 years, in the short term, to move us toward optimal care and optimal quality and value. And so we organized the focus around 11 critical areas, and the top four ones are ones that we asked all the stakeholder work groups to address, and then the seven further ones are ones that were groups could choose among.
Okay.
So that's and there are a wealth of recommendations,
yes.
And it's really designed so people can go in and look at areas of interest and find things they want to take on in their own communities.
All right. Well, it's definitely substantial stuff, and this gets to the revamping part. Maureen, do you want to talk a little bit about some of these recommendations? We agreed that we'd have to have a WIHI show on probably each one of them, and we can certainly come back to this at a future date. But maybe, Maureen, talk about a couple, and I also was going to ask Sue and Peter to talk a little bit about clinical controversies.
Sure. Actually, this morning, Madge, we switched around the order, and Rima was going to address some of the specific recommendations.
Okay.
So I'm going to turn it back over to her and pop in later.
Okay, sounds good. Rima?
Okay, sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, starting out with performance measurement, I'm sure many people are aware, but not everybody may be, that the National Quality Forum came out with 17 perinatal measures, and five of those have been taken up by the Joint Commission for reporting in the hospital setting. And one of the things that we felt, we tried to pick out things that would be relevant to people in clinical microsystems. I think that's the bulk of the IHI community, people who actually are providing direct care to mothers and families and babies, as well as people within systems that are trying to improve. So one of the things that we recommended was that systems and people in practices get together and try to develop and field test measures and sponsor them for endorsement by NQF. And there are lots and lots of gaps in care. The 17 starter measures are a wonderful contribution to getting us to maybe all play off the same sheet of music and having a way to find out how much fidelity there is and how much reliability there is to best evidence. But then we need a way to collect and report those data and use them to improve care. So there are recommendations around that. And in the area of disparities, there's really a need to develop disparity-sensitive measures. So that's another thing that systems could be working on. Also, in terms of disparities, I mean, there are many things that could be tested out for their comparative effectiveness, things like language translation, using doulas, home visitations, mm-hmm. Models of care coordination, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some things.
Okay.
I was going to mention briefly the clinical controversies area because I thought that would give Sue and Pete something to respond to.
Okay.
But in an overview, I think what we want in that area is policies and practices that foster safe physiologic birth for the majority of women who are healthy and at low risk, with access to appropriate specialty services for those that need it, but really an attention on decreasing excessive use of elective procedures and interventions, as Pete was just saying. And there are lots of things that could be done in the community setting, things like regular multi-stakeholder peer review of elective inductions and non-medical primary cesarean sections and repeat C-sections to see if they're warranted, team training and interdisciplinary problem solving and communication, looking at putting together coordination teams between facilities and community providers, including emergency transport, people who provide care in birth centers in the home, to really coordinate and take the fragmentation out of the transition from the community to the facility. Benchmarking programs, particularly for things like VBAC, setting some target rates and looking to see what's happening within the system. And then, like Sue said, training programs for obstetrical nurses and for all primary maternity care providers on comfort measures, on labor support, and things that support, say, physiologic childbirth. So those are just a few things that come to the top of the list.
Okay, that's very, very good. Thank you so much. Maureen, did you want to jump in, or should I go to Sue now with a little more about the clinical controversies?
That would be fine, but yeah. I'd like to come back and speak to one more recommendation when Sue's finished.
Okay, sounds good. So okay. I was going to ask you, Sue, and Peter, chime in as needed. So in terms of the clinical controversies, I mean, I am sure part of the way in which Sue and I often email is sort of the things I see in the news, and then I shoot them to her, and then she shoots them back to me, and we're looking at pretty much all these issues, I think, that are sort of flying around right now. So tell me, Sue, how you are trying in some ways to kind of wrap your arms around these controversies.
Well, Madge, I did a lot of work on decreasing cesarean sections in the 90s, and so when we first undertook the perinatal work again at IHI, we focused on the safe use of oxytocin, which makes the assumption that people are in the hospital and need to have a drug to get their labor. And where we have focused our work, are their labor moving? So we've focused our work on that drug as a means of calling attention to people in the hospital setting of actually the use of that drug and the overuse of and misuse of that the drug oxytocin. And so through the work that we've been doing and through when we look at clinical controversies,
Elective induction is what is listed in one of those areas. And so we have, by calling attention to the use of this medication, the safe delivery of that medication, people have now changed practice to, number Pete already mentioned, decreasing elective delivery prior to 39 weeks. But now once that delivery occurs, they're actually recognizing how, as the patient comes in, if they're even looking at the 39-week use, that there's overuse of the resources at the hospital setting, overuse of nurses because they're involved with patients for an extended period of time. So, again, we're shifting the recognition of the system that we're in and all of the downside effects of taking action, say, with elective induction. And we have to take into this. The patient seeks some of this as well. In our current society, they want to know their delivery date. And so, you know, trying to undo that, engage patients as part of this has been a significant piece of work.
Okay, thanks. Peter, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, extension on just what we already said and the misuse, overuse idea. I mean, a tool, many of the tools that we have were appropriately developed for use in the right setting. And, you know, you use a screwdriver as a hammer and a piece breaks off and goes in your eye. It doesn't make the tool bad. It just means your application was not appropriate. And focusing back on when the appropriate, with education around when the appropriate use of this is, and focusing on that, we've seen, for instance, a continual drop of operative adjuvant deliveries. We saw a dramatic drop here, and we've seen it happen locally, nationally as well, over the last few years. So, again, education around the issue is important, as you mentioned about the current and other providers as well. People want to do the best thing, they want to do the right thing, and education around each of these issues has helped, at least in our interventions and interactions, both through the IHI impact group as well as myself locally. The providers are getting used to a standard of oversight and accountability that is acceptable. They to some extent embrace that because it keeps them operating not only efficiently but ideally, which is what we want in our professional lives.
Okay, thank you. All right, that's Dr. Peter Cerruni in Vermont. And Maureen Corey, bring you back in here, and then we're going to open things up for questions and comments.
Great, thank you. I just wanted to call attention to one of the stakeholder groups that I think did an exceptional job coming up with recommendations, and that was the Consumer and Their Advocates Work Group. And they developed some beautiful recommendations regarding decision-making and consumer choice, which I think is important to all of us who want to provide woman and family-centered care. And one of their chief recommendations was to expand opportunities and capacity for shared decision-making processes and also to develop tools and resources that can help facilitate shared decision-making between women and their providers, and also to design a system that incentivizes providers and consumers for engaging in healthy lifestyles and making good choices. And Sue mentioned, I think Sue was the one who referenced childbirth education, and we think it's really, really important to revive and broaden the reach of childbirth education through by looking at new models and innovative teaching modalities. And then lastly, as it relates to how do women view the world of maternity care, which is so important, we think it's essential that we begin to promote a cultural shift in attitudes towards childbearing and make women see that their bodies were made to give birth and that childbirth for most women is a normal physiologic process. So I just wanted to call attention to those, I think, really important recommendations.
Thanks, Maureen. And I guess just a quick follow-up. Who historically has done a lot of the childbirth education? And when we reference new models, are we looking for new entities or new infrastructure to support that? Just curious, or anybody?
Well, this is Sue again, and in my past, I was a childbirth educator, and there are multiple ways of learning. There are educators within communities who provide this, who may not be nurses. Nurses have provided the model. There is Lamaze International. I don't want to leave people off the list, but there are certainly many groups that are involved with childbirth education and with engaging patients. There are doulas. There are lots of resources that are out there. I think the struggle that many of us face is that that women are not accessing them currently, that they often feel that if they give in for at least hospital birth, that once they come into the hospital, they don't need those skills anymore. Epidurals have sort of replaced the traditional childbirth model, and that's my own take on a lot of this. But as I travel the country and outside of the country, it also has become a model. So returning to empowerment of women to give birth and seek out those resources is a huge area that I think the media needs to help us with and many other avenues.
Okay, thanks.
And Maureen,
go ahead. Yeah?
Yeah, this is Rima. I had a couple of other thoughts.
Yeah.
I mean, there are two things that come to mind. One is that younger women are very used to using social marketing and social media. And so, you know, there are a lot of ways that we could better leverage information if we could, you know, use subscriptions that could be podcasts or downloaded onto personal devices or a central My Pregnancy space. So there are a lot of things that could be leveraged. And then another thing that I think is enjoying more attention is models of group prenatal care, like the centering pregnancy model, that bring women together in a forum where they can discuss and receive education in a format that is empowering and often more acceptable, because it's not just education, it's also their care, and it's also social networking and resource building. So those are two ideas I have for revitalizing education.
All right, sounds really good. Well, maybe that's a nice jumping off point. We'll see what else some of the people who've joined us today, what kinds of ideas other people have for that, and also levers here. I have a lot more questions. Sue and I were talking earlier, and I think all of us also, as we were planning today, a little bit more about how the health policy arena can help reinforce and enhance what's coming with healthcare reform legislation. And then I promise everyone, we will not leave today without having a sense, when we talk mobilization, sort of ways that people can engage with this work going forward. Somebody is asking, certified nurse midwife, and we were looking over the enrollment for today, and we have a really interesting cross-section of people who are active in this area. Jennifer, as a certified nurse midwife at a freestanding birth center, what can I do to help this change? I feel women's attitude about their ability is so very important to normalize birth and change parenting and thus society. And I think those are the fundamental sort of shifts in outlook we're talking about. But I don't know. And any one of you, feel free. I don't necessarily have to call on anyone if you're chiming to answer. This is somebody as a certified nurse midwife, and there are many others, I think, who are in that same position today. Maureen or Rima, you want to take that?
Sure, I'll give it a stab, Madge.
Okay.
Jennifer, thank you for doing what you're doing. And I think the best thing to do is keep on doing it. And as more and more women learn about birth settings outside the hospital, in freestanding birth centers or even at home, it's more likely to spread. In fact, when you look at what's happening in birth, the birth setting that's growing most rapidly in our country is home birth. So, and Madge, you mentioned before healthcare reform and how will that help enable this. And the good news is that as a result of healthcare reform, Medicaid is now required to pay the facility fees for women who give birth in freestanding birth centers.
Wow. Okay, that's
significant.
So that's
an opportunity. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Jennifer, for doing what you're doing, and keep at it.
All right. Debbie, thank you, Rima. Debbie is asking, also working as a perinatal, from Debbie to host, we got another Isabel in here, perinatal nurse educator at British Columbia Women's Hospital in Canada. Wondering about the focus on nursing care, reflecting the fact that nurses are so intensively involved in this whole process, and how any of the work in terms of what's on the radar screen with Childbirth Connection and the vision, the Blueprint for Action, or Sue in the perinatal work, kind of how do we sort of put nurses in the frame here?
Well, this is Sue, and that's a really key area. So thank you, Isabel, for bringing that up. And we have found in the current practice for a lot of places, at least in the hospital, and again, that's my sphere of influence or knowledge, is that we often, with the system, we often focus a lot on the technology when we train nurses in labor and delivery. So they're trained in electronic fetal monitoring, they're trained in the use of medications, but very rarely is labor support one of their key areas of both knowledge and education, but then also credentialing. And so changing some of that is a huge opportunity that we have. That labor support and those skills that are needed at the bedside with patients is a huge area. In our work, we're focusing on some safety work in the second stage of labor, and one of the key pieces has been that for the majority of nurses caring for patients in the second stage of labor often are the nurses that do not have the most experience on the unit. And so how does it impact what type of delivery outcome we see? So there's a huge area in looking at nursing and the system that supports them and having the skills to take care of patients in the hospital, and I'm sure that translates to freestanding birth centers as well, although the models are a little bit different with nurse midwives there.
Okay, thanks, Sue Gullo. Again, it's WIHI, and this is Madge Kaplan. Somebody want to chime in there?
Yeah, this is Rima. Uh-huh. The other thing that was occurring to me when Sue was talking is that in my experience, and certainly the couple of times that I've come out to the IHI community meetings, perinatal community meetings, what I see is that nurses are oftentimes the standard bearers and the sort of the momentum creators and builders and for quality improvement projects on the labor and delivery floor. And so I think that's one way to involve and mobilize the nurses. That in the blueprint, for example, there are many, many examples of facility level projects to bring in other stakeholders and to form a quality collaborative and to get a project going, like the IHI projects, and there's lots of overlap in them. But I think nurses often are the standard bearers and the real energy behind those. So.
Okay, thanks, Rima.
Thanks, Rima. Rima, thank you for pointing that out, because I think nursing, not only should they, because they currently do, but I think this is a challenge that they need to step up that leadership role even more.
There's a question from Catherine, who's actually, this is related, can we encourage organizations such as the, and I'm not going to know what NCC is, to offer certification for nurses in labor support or other organizations such as A1?
Well, as I've learned over the last couple of days in a special training I've been privileged to be part of, that one by one we can change the world. So there's a lot of callers on this call, and I think we certainly at IHI will find the appropriate ways for you to get that information and that request.
What is NCC, by the way?
It's the National Certification Center.
Got it. Okay, very, very good. Roger asks a good question, which I think gets kind of also closer to the policy issues regarding vaginal birth after cesarean or VBACs, as people call them. People continue to become more and more risk-averse, he says, and do you see pathways for shifting this mindset, both in lay terms and also professional liability terms? We have not actually touched upon much the environment. Also, another way that all this stuff churns in the news media really has to do with malpractice, fears of lawsuits, et cetera, and defensive medicine. Any one of you want to dive into that thicket here in terms of, we're talking about mindset changes on both, the birthing mother's side, family members, as well as on the physician side. Peter, do I dare call on you for that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Speak up again. Your soft-spoken voice. We're making you speak loud. Thanks.
And as I mentioned just last month, there was a consensus conference around the issue of vaginal birth after cesarean. And as early as 2002, 2003, when we began to see a drop-off in VBACs, in these vaginal births after cesareans locally, both in New Hampshire and Vermont, when we initially went through our project to look at the reasons, we had to remind hospitals that the risks they're dealing with around VBAC are no different than what they're dealing with every day around many other issues. Whether it's 5 to 6 per thousand, or 0.5%, or 1%, they're dealing with the same reality in managing these patients if stable, healthy patient comes in and has an acute fetal issue or has an abruption, or so they need to be prepared to manage this. And as last month pointed out at NICHD, that is indeed the case, and the professional organizations have not helped around some of the wording that they put out in their professional information. So again, moving toward changing the language so we understand where our risk base is, and that we're able to manage those risks if we elect to do obstetrics in our hospital, because they're the same and equitable risks we're dealing with on a daily basis in all our other patients. It also takes education. It's a community expectation. We're lucky enough here in Vermont to have always had a community expectation around VBAC, so we've maintained a high level of a high percent, if you will, although we've still seen a drop by about a third. Where we were traditionally in the mid to high 40s, we're now around 30%. But nationally, it's pretty well under 10%. So again, education and recognition around the risks that we're making assumptions that we are, the term risk averse has been used, yet the risks come out later. We carried maybe one patient every 1 to 2 years who had serious placental-based issues, which could cost her life, much less her pregnancy. And now we regularly carry 1 to 2 patients. We see 1 to 2 patients a month with specific placental-based issues, which are focused on their primary or their second cesarean section. Mm-hmm. So we have to understand those risks moving forward. We have to make sure we translate those risks to the patients, and then they recognize the risks. So I'm pretty sure we're not doing, as a large group, we're not doing our job right now. And we need to get that information to the right individuals in the right place.
Peter, an interesting follow-up. I'll just keep you on the hot seat here for just another second. Somebody is asking, I mean, there's two kind of related questions. One person is asking about the dichotomy between needing to train physicians to be non-interventive in their approach to childbirth and yet having the skills for the rare event. Another physician or participant today is, I shouldn't presume that necessarily, is a physician, is asking a little bit about what kinds of barriers, how do you begin to change a practice at a facility or a hospital around this 39-week thing, if that has not been sort of effectively brought about before. So maybe, Peter, let me have you take the first one, and then Sue is smiling, so because she's smiling, I'm going to pick on her for the second one. Okay.
Well, sure. A lot of it is just around the education, around the data, really over the last 2 years that consistently has supported 39 weeks as the lowest overall morbidity. So for an elective delivery, it's hard for me, and we need to educate that it should be hard to set up the rationale for delivery prior to 39 weeks in the elective setting, even by a day. In fact, around the March of Dimes issue and around that specific issue, the reason we define term as 37 to 41 weeks is because of outcome data. Now that we have outcome data that supports 37 to 38 weeks is different from 39, we've asked the question, and we will strongly consider nationally whether we should change the definition of term to 39 to 41 weeks. And in that setting, that just like changing near term to late preterm in the 34 to 36 six weeks patients, that changing of that term alone will drive a lot, not only from the patient perspective, but as well as from the provider perspective. But ultimately, it's accountability, reminding individuals what the baseline indications are, what the professional recommendations are, what the current data shows, and people do change their practice. It shouldn't take the time that it does. That frustrates us, especially when, again, in aviation, there might be an event happening right now, and within two months, they'll figure out what the issue is, and then that day, every pilot is made aware of it, and we'll have a checklist or we'll have some kind of follow-up to manage that issue. We need much better dissemination and accountability around that dissemination and incorporation into practice around the management, clear management changes that occur.
OK. Okay, Sue, jump in.
Yeah. Probably not going to answer the question directly because I think we could spend weeks on any of the comments that are coming in. I think what our opportunity is here, though, is to look at the resources such as the ones that we're focused on today, the Blueprint for Action, and moving forward and bringing that up for discussion in any group that you were involved in. And so taking these examples or taking these recommendations and bringing them to the quality improvement level of your individual organizations. The recent NIH meeting on vaginal birth after cesarean has posted a significant amount of materials that will help people in this guide. There are quality improvement projects happening across the United States besides the IHI work that's all linked. And so I would say even with the 39-week piece, if people are involved in organizations that it's currently normal to deliver electively prior to 39 weeks, that they're missing something because, again, the wave is really building into a sort of tsunami that some of these practices are not evidence-based and they're not safe. And so taking these available resources and tools, bringing them to the local level and beginning to look at what is your local opportunity is a huge piece of work. There is not going to be a magic wand that transforms the United States unless we all take this individually and the responsibility to begin to move it forward.
Okay, thank you very much, Sue and Peter. Listen, Sue is right. We're getting some really interesting and substantive questions and comments. If you are on chat and you're logged in, reminder to everyone, you can download this chat when you log off today. Anyone who has just joined us by phone today and doesn't have access to the chat and the conversation, you're welcome to email us at info@ihi.org, and I'll be happy to forward the chat to you because there's a lot of really interesting stuff going back and forth. Rima and Maureen, I want to turn to you. There's several people are asking in various ways about 9 to 5. It was referred to earlier by Sue, and that being kind of a schedule of healthcare that, in some respects, that doesn't necessarily match what goes on with birth. Either one of you want to address that? People are asking kind of how do we begin to kind of alter that mindset and that kind of a system?
Sure. This is Rima. I'll take a stab. I wanted to quickly say something about the last caller's question that Pete and Sue were talking about and just go back to, I think, a really important point that she raised in her question about needing physicians to be non-interventive and yet building skills. And I think we need to recognize that, given what Pete said, that many of the things that that are considered controversial carry levels of risk that are actually quite equivalent with other things that we don't perceive somehow as so risky. In that mashup, what seems to be happening is that some really important skills that could support a less interventive outcome are going by the wayside. So things like knowing how to deliver a vaginal breech, and when people don't, then they go right to what they're comfortable with, which is cesarean. So I thought that was a very good point.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the 9-to-5 model of birth, one of the things that many of the work groups identified as a possible area for study and something that could be looked at is the impact that the laborist model, laborists are hospitalists who focus on labor and birth, and they can be physicians, they can be nurse midwives. But looking at the impact that that model might have on some of these issues around quality of life for providers and around the impact of external pressures on the timing of labor because of scheduling that happen when people are juggling their ambulatory clinic population and the people who are giving birth in the facility. It's possible that looking at this laborist model and studying the impact that it could have on liability, on women's experiences, on continuous labor support, on all kinds of measures, on VBAC, would be an interesting thing to do. So that's one of the recommendations.
Okay, thank you very much. Maureen, I think I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to sort of have you kind of kick us off. You're welcome, of course, to respond to that, but I think we're kind of getting to the part of the program where we need to sort of have some thoughts to leave everybody with. So feel free to answer that question as well as maybe some ideas that you want to leave people with.
Sure. Before I kind of sum up the childbirth connection piece, I just wanted to let everybody know that I came across preliminary 2008 data that was released just this week by CDC. And the good news is that the preterm birth rate has declined by 3% in 1 year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, you know, I'd be interested in hearing Pete and Sue whether you think that has anything to do with reduction in elective cesareans before 39 weeks gestation. But that's some good news to share. But going back to our Transforming Maternity Care project and what's next, I think Remus said at the release event that we had at the Kaiser Family Foundation in Washington, D.C., that giving birth is the easy part. The hard part now is to implement our recommendations, like the hard part is to grow a child.
Right.
So what we're trying to do now is to establish a multi-stakeholder public-private partnership to carry out the next phase of this initiative and to implement blueprint steps. And we are forming a Transforming Maternity Care Partnership Action Community, which will be up on our website within the next month. And we're encouraging individuals and health care systems and microsystems to sign up if they're interested and share their stories about what they're doing to improve care. We're also developing a series of webinars on all the 11 topics covered in the blueprint, and we'll be asking experts like Pete and Sue and others to do webinars, and we'll be reaching out to a wide community to engage them in the webinar process. And we're also right now working with partners to identify core projects that we'd like to do in collaboration with others to get towards implementation of the blueprint. And we have five or six of those in the works right now, but nothing that's absolutely definitive to report. But there's been a lot of interest in getting engaged in this process. We've been so overwhelmed with the gratitude and the generosity of so many healthcare providers who are really ready to jump on board. They're doing things, you all are doing things in your community, and we encourage you to share what you're doing with us so we can share those resources with other people as well.
All right. Thank you so much, Maureen Corey. And I encourage everyone to check out the website, A Childbirth Connection, and also resources we'll put on our own website. I also want to remind everybody that on May 14th, IHI is launching what we call an expedition, part of our passport program. It's a virtual learning opportunity in a specific improvement area. This particular expedition is going to be centered on improving perinatal safety through implementation of the oxytocin bundle. And guess who's leading that? Sue Gullo and Peter Cheruny. If you want to participate, you can find out more information. There's also a place to enroll on IHI.org. And actually, you'll find all that by the end of this week. All right, Peter, parting shots for you, parting thoughts.
Well, I think I'd sum up a lot of what a number of people have said, that, you know, like, number one, delivering babies, like educating children, it's not like building cars. But at the same time, we do need to right size and put the skill where it's needed when it's needed. And we don't want to be overskilled, because when we're overskilled in a certain setting, we tend to overdo. And I think that's a constant message we've heard. And we want the right trained person to be in the right setting and not look at degrees or not look at et cetera and decide how to create that vision with appropriate skill present at the time it's needed. And I would certainly agree completely with what was said around that. I don't know exactly what that model looks like, but that's where we ought to be moving toward. And
right,
I think
that's what we're working on. Okay, thank you so much, Peter Cheruny. That's what we're working on. Quickly, Rima and Sue, we're kind of at time, so we're going to try and wrap up. Rima?
Sure. Well, I just go back to what I said about the blueprint in the beginning, that it aims to answer the question, who needs to do what to, with, and for whom to improve the quality and value of maternity care. And it is designed to be a blueprint. So what we hope for, I mean, we Childbirth Connection can do a few major projects, but we won't be able to carry all of this out. So we designed it with the hope that people will jump in and look at those 11 critical focus areas and say, this is the one that really grabs me, and then look for something that they can do and take forward in their communities and reaching out to others.
Okay, thank you. And Sue Gullo.
I would just say in wrapping up that we have a tremendous opportunity now here in the U.S. to really change the momentum, to reflect on the how we all can own pieces of this or all of it. And I want to thank Maureen and Rima for putting together the fabulous work that was done in the Blueprint for Action. And I think if all of you look at the participant list, whether it was the steering committee, the actual groups, you'll see a very multidisciplinary mix of people that are involved in this, and so the in moving forward, this isn't about one area. It's about how we together can change care in the United States from this point moving forward. So, Madge, thanks for hosting this for us.
Well, it's wonderful, and there is so much rich conversation going on the chat. Even as we're about to log off, a lot of people are now having a conversation on the chat about underlying issues contributing to a lot of complications. That sounds to me like it may be the basis for another program sometime soon, if I can get on Sue's schedule. But I want to thank my guests today. They really brought forward a lot of important work going on. Thanks to all the participants. Again, you can download the chat when you get off. You can also download any of the slides today. Check out the resources on the resource document that we put together. And by this time tomorrow, maybe even by the end of today, if you go to the archive page of the WIHI, web pages, you can find the audio recording of the program. Also, just want to remind everybody that on April 22nd, that's 2 weeks from now, we're going to be back to our 2 to 3 p.m. time slot, Eastern Time. We've got a truly unique orthopedic surgeon, a surgeon with me, Tony DeGioia, who's taken many of the principles behind patient and family-centered care, and he's developed an implementation methodology that's rich and thoughtful and very helpful. Dale Schaller is going to be with us as well. We hope you'll check that out. Information about that is on the website right now. Finally, the people who make WIHI possible are Jonathan Small, Mike Sweeney, Jesse McCall, Alan Olison, Brittany McPhee, Jane Rossner, Vicki Minden, and Matthew Morris, who's here as well. The musical selections that you hear just before WIHI begins are performed and arranged by Patricio and Jennifer Batayas. Aaron Flanders and Miguel Sapasoa are responsible for the music that opens and closes the program. It is really my privilege, I hope you can tell that, to host a program that's about spirited learning and improving patient care most of all for the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. I'm Madge Kaplan. Thanks for staying with us as we ran over a few minutes. Good day.